Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Seitz. We actually record these on a program called Zencaster so that I can sit here in Wisconsin, and our guest can be in Tallahassee, Florida, and our producer can be in Washington, D.C., and the thing comes out completely seamless because technology, right? So what happens is that the various guests will sign in. So they'll be, you know, my name will be Charlie Sykes, and then Jim Swift, who is our producer, his name shows up. And then miraculously, about 2 minutes ago, the name Rick Gorka pops up. Our guest, Rick Gorka. First time we've actually ever been trolled by somebody. So just say that deep inside, Rick Wilson, you would like to be like a Seb Gorka.
You know, the phrase deep inside Seb Gorka is what I understand to be his 1970s porn work, but
you stick your head in a bucket of eels.
In a bucket of eels.
He worked on that. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure he thought to himself, this is brilliant rhetoric, and I shall tell this scoundrel to stick his head in a bucket of eels.
Well, Rick, we wanted to have you back on because I realized that we have not had an explicit rating on our podcast in months.
Right.
So I'm your huckleberry
when it comes to that.
we were on a roll for a while. So there's so much to talk about this morning. And you have an updated version of your book coming out on August 15th, which people are, I assume you're sounding the alarm. We want to get to that in just a moment. And I want to talk about all the people who hate Project Lincoln and why they hate Project Lincoln. But should we start with, I don't know, you choose, Jared Kushner or the president's call to Fox and Friends this morning?
Well, I think let's start with Fox and Friends, because this is once again the president calling his comfort bunny, his safe space, and deciding that he is he's listened to his noted epidemiologists like Diamond and Silk and Peter Navarro, and has decided that kids don't get COVID.
Okay, well let's just play this, Jim. This is the president of the United States calling into Fox and Friends this morning.
What is the latest on your view of how these schools should reopen?
My view is the school should open. This thing's going away. It will go away like things go away. And my view is that school should be open. If you look at children are almost, and I would almost say definitely, but almost immune from this disease. So few. They've got stronger, hard to believe. I don't know how you feel about it, but they have much stronger immune systems than we do somehow for this.
Oh my, it's just going to go away. It's like it's magic. It will just disappear. And you can bet your children's life on it, Rick
Wilson. You know, I mean, if I'm thinking of somebody who has good judgment and a history of successful execution of major consequential programs where lives are on the line, I think Donald Trump I don't. This is another one of these magical thinking moments from Donald Trump. And he's there with his, like I said, his friends from his safe space in the morning. And so the fact that they just let him say things like that, the fact that they just let him riff on things like that, I guarantee you everybody in the White House press office this morning, you know, if they'd had a lump of coal in their ass, a diamond would pop out. They're so nervous. They're thinking, oh God, our whole day is now going to be cleanup of this guy saying the same kind of crazy shit that we always
but
have.
Every
to clean
day
up.
Is like that for them these days. Every single day. There's a stream. Remember, we all thought the Chris Wallace interview, well, it can't get any worse than this. And then he goes, sits down with Jonathan Swan. And like, oh my God, what was that? And then while people are still processing, you know, the craziness of the Jonathan Swan interview, he calls into Fox and Friends and waves the magic wand about millions of kids who are about to go back to school.
Jonathan Swan was like the five finger quivering palm death touch of interviews. It was such a moment where it also shows you just how Trump relies on one of two kinds of interviews. The Fox and Friends thing he did this morning, which was very typical of Trump and, you know, riffing and just stream of consciousness. And the press conference kind of thing where he can always answer one question with an insult and then jump to OANN. Mm-hmm. Or answer one question with an insult and look around the room for some friendly face to ask him a question like, Mr. President, aren't you the tallest, smartest, handsomest man to ever walk the earth? So, and then he can, you know, go off and make sure his delicate ego is protected. But, you know, this interview this morning and this push to reopen the schools, there is no plan. There is no plan. Betsy DeVos doesn't have a plan. Donald Trump doesn't have a plan. This is purely political, and they are asking Americans to put their children's lives and, frankly, their lives at risk for Donald Trump's electoral prospects.
You know, I mentioned this to Tom Nichols on the podcast yesterday. Some of the most extraordinary things about what the president is saying is the fact that he's not even trying. You know, for example, when he's asked about John Lewis by Jonathan Swan, you know, he doesn't even pretend to be a normal human being with normal human emotions and empathy. And this morning goes on. And again, you have millions of parents who have a certain level of anxiety about sending their children back. There doesn't appear to be a plan in place to open schools in many areas. You have even Dr. Birx who's saying, hey, and you know, in hotspot areas, probably not a good idea. Right. And what does the president do? Ah, the kids are almost immune, nothing to worry about. Let's just do this.
Send them back.
I mean, you think there clearly was no attempt to even give him a talking point on this.
Well, if they did, he couldn't internalize it or analyze it. But I think there are a group of people around the president who he listens to about COVID and contagion and the medical questions. And I think it's folks like Peter Navarro and Wilbur Ross and Jared who are all blazingly incompetent about this. And he touched on it yesterday during the Axios interview. He says, oh, if we'd gone to herd, it would have been different. There is a little faction in the White House that thinks that herd immunity is the way to beat the disease. Well, there's, given the contagion level, the R-naught level of this disease, herd immunity is not working out for us until we get some sort of vaccine into the mix. And that's not there yet by a good stretch. So,
and there might have been a million deaths before you get to that if you'd gone for herd. Right.
You probably would. If you did the math on herd, it's not a pretty picture.
Good grief. Well, you know, I was thinking about the Jonathan Swan interview, and the significance of that was, I mean, obviously the way it was very effective and exposed Donald Trump, but we've sort of done that before. But also, I think it was a masterclass for other interviewers. And I think that's the significance, is that it's going to give other interviewers a little bit of backbone because they want to be him as opposed to, you know, Sean Hannity. And I think that the point is slow it down, ask follow-up questions, challenge him, ask him that second and third layer question, because that's when it really gets interesting. And after every one of these interviews occurs, I start noticing how other hosts on other channels begin to become a little bit more aggressive. And by aggressive, I mean, you know, not tolerating the bullshit. You know, not letting Mercedes Schlapp get away with just peddling misinformation about mail-in voting. And so there is an effect, a good effect that comes from a strong interview like Jonathan Swan.
I think that Jonathan's interview should have a salutary effect on reporters because. You know, look, the pinnacle of a White House reporter's career is the one-on-one with the president. And all of them have a calculus in their mind of, I can't go too hard. And this is with everybody, by the way, not just with Trump. I can't go too hard because I want the one-on-one. That's the level up moment for a lot of White House reporters. And so Swan went into that interview with the correct approach, which was go do journalism. Go commit news. Go in there and treat this like it doesn't matter if the guy ever talks to you again. And Trump may never talk to him again. Mm-hmm. Okay. He may never answer another question from him again. But there are plenty of reporters in the White House who have for 4 years now taken it, you know, they've been critical-ish, but they never quite get up and make the president look like the fool that he is, as Swan did. And Swan didn't do anything to Donald Trump. He let Donald Trump be himself and therefore came across as a clown.
Okay, I'm going to say this. I'm probably going to say this, use the wrong words here, but I think one of the strengths that Jonathan Swan brought to this was that he treated Donald Trump like a normal person, by which I mean, if you're sitting in a room with a non-Donald Trump, non-president of the United States, and they spout this kind of bullshit, you react that way. You go, whoa, what do you mean? As opposed to, well, Mr. President, let's move on to the next issue, your position on North Korea, whatever. It was like, no, I'm sitting in a room with a guy who clearly does not understand math, does not understand charts, is spouting the most incredibly, the most incredible nonsense and crackpottery. And I think that really gave it that sense that react like you would to anyone else who is behaving in this particular way.
I think that's exactly right, Charlie, that he didn't. He didn't have that sort of patronizing aspect to it.
Right.
This guy's so slow, we have to treat him with kid gloves. Nor did he have, he let him do the work. He let him do the difficult part of beclowning himself. And that is a different approach than so many White House reporters can take. They just can't quite get their heads around it.
Well, let me tell you a short story. It's a very, very short story because over the weekend I had to write something and I was sitting there and feeling the frustration of having spent 4 years writing about Donald Trump and realizing that every story is basically, it's really bad plus 800 words.
Right.
We've done this. We've written it. And I mentioned this to a family friend yesterday that I was at the, Trump sucks plus 800 words phase of this. And he said, yeah, it does feel like everything has been said. He said, except for that guy, that Rick Wilson, always comes up with some new way of doing it. And that is the essential responsibility right now. We kind of know everything about Donald Trump. We've seen everything about Donald Trump, but how do you make it vivid? How do you make it fresh? How do you come at it with a different angle? I mean, isn't that what you do when you wake up every morning?
Yeah, I mean, look, I have to approach this every day as attacking the Death Star. There are a lot of things that you can do against Donald Trump that don't work anymore. And one of the things is, and I made this mistake in 15 and 16, where I believed you could shame Republican elected officials into getting away from Donald Trump. You can't. You can't shame them. Their fear outweighs their shame every time. Mm-hmm. But I am always looking for an approach, and our creative team is always looking for an approach that either litigates the case with the public against Trump in ways that he can't just bullshit his way out of. The death count is a big one, driving American voters fairly dramatically. And we've known from several different pieces of survey research that about 65% of the people who have changed their vote from Trump to Biden have done so because of COVID. Hmm. When we're litigating the case against Trump, we're not trying to like go and refute his bullshit like promises and the ludicrous nature of all those things. People already know that. They know he's basically full of crap. What we are doing now is making them understand how it has hurt them directly, personally, in the states. We have ads up in, we did the famous Morning in America ad, our reboot of the Reagan ad.
Right.
Well, now we have Morning in Ohio running, and Morning in Wisconsin, and Morning in Michigan. And those things are out there in a way that bolts it down for people in the states where it says, hey, in Ohio, X thousand people have died of this disease. They didn't have to. X thousand, families are homeless now. They didn't have to be. X thousand people are jobless. They didn't have to be. And so we've managed to do that, I think, pretty effectively. And we're going to be entering more of that kind of campaigning as we move toward the persuasion phase of the election. The other area in which we excel is going after the president in a very direct and meaningful way inside his own brain. Mm-hmm. And to go after Trump's psychology. And the amazing thing about it is I'm able, and my team is able, and the LP team is able on every domain, whether it's on social media or earned media or paid media or digital media, to go after Donald Trump's ego and his psychological defects and weaknesses and to make him think of nothing else. And some people say, oh, you're just trolling the president. Well, as my buddy John Weaver says, it's not trolling when there's a fish on the hook. And Donald Trump, every day he's attacking us is a day he's not attacking Joe Biden. Every day he's paralyzed with fear or anger about us, he's not doing the work of a campaign.
This is a real thing. I once worked with someone, not really in Trump's class of craziness, but of thin-skinned nature. And this person would get one email or see one thing that was critical, and they were gone for the day. That was it. And I remember having conversations with saying, you can't let this happen. You are held hostage. You have one person who says one bad thing about you and you become ineffective for a day. Now, you know, scale that up to the president of the United States. And we are what? How many days are we out from this campaign?
89 days.
Every single day that he is off his game is a day he's never going to get back. And that's crucial. Okay, let's talk about your latest ad, because over the weekend when I was thinking about like, what can you say that's new? I wrote about the story from Vanity Fair about Jared Kushner leading that completely ineffective task force, which was supposed to come up with nationwide testing that nothing ever came of. And the suggestion was in the story that one of the reasons why they dropped the plans for the nationwide testing is because they said, hey, it's just a blue state problem. It's just Democrats were dying, so we don't have to do anything. We can blame the Democratic governors. We could make this a political edge, which is a pretty... Even for those of us who are numbed, if you think through the implications, well, here's your latest ad from the Lincoln Project going right after the fail son-in-law.
President Trump gives lots of jobs to his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Insiders whisper he may be even more powerful than Trump. But like his father-in-law, Jared's not up to the task. This pampered princeling has never met a problem he couldn't f*** up. Take the COVID response Trump assigned Jared to handle. 150,000 people dead and an economy in ruins.
By July, the country's really rocking again.
His task force put Trump cronies first. And of course, Jared's family cashed in on bailout money. No surprise from the son of a convicted felon and slumlord who served time in prison. Jared's a perfect fit for this White House. But if you've ever wondered whether this president took COVID-19 seriously, look no further than who he put in charge of protecting America's health. Jared Kushner, Trump's Secretary of Failure. The Lincoln Project is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Oh, sweet Jeebus. That is like, as like, burn it down, salt the field.
You know, the ironic thing about that ad is when I started talking to the guys and we started scripting it out, it was about a 4-minute ad. We could have done a video. We could have done a mini documentary on Jared Kushner's absolutely stellar degree of screwing the pooch on every single thing he's ever been involved with in this White House. And this is the guy that was going to be Middle East peace and reforming the government and the opioid crisis and a million other things. And none of those things have worked out because Jared is not a competent person. He is not a capable person. And the fact that Donald Trump, you know, the old Steve Jobs rule of A's hire B's and B's hire C's. Well, A's hire B's and B's hire C's, and Donald Trump hires people that could not manage a Waffle House. And so we end up with guys like Jared. And frankly, you know, with the COVID response, Jared has been, you know, this revelation from the Vanity Fair article, which you talked about, that he essentially decided he would triage states on a political basis. And that is, to me, shockingly amoral and yet completely unsurprising.
Okay, so is this one of the ads that's aimed at the swing voter, or is this getting inside Donald Trump's head? Because there's a throwaway line in there where some people think that Jared Kushner is even more powerful than Donald Trump. Okay.
Look, these ads are meant, this ad in particular, is an audience of one or audience of two ad. Mm-hmm. And I will say this, because Jared should understand this. Jared has been one of the big cheerleaders inside of Trump world for the Lincoln Project must be destroyed. And he has engaged in some behaviors and had the campaign engage in some behaviors that have taken it well beyond our political space and put it in the put it in the zone of very, very personal. And if he wants to continue down that path, I'm happy to do so. And one of the things he should be mindful of, and I'm sure he's hearing about it right now, this ad isn't just running on cable. It's running on the Upper East Side and Upper West Side. Mm. It's running on Wall Street. It's running in DC and Calorama. It is running in places where all Jared's friends are going to see it. So, you know, this idea that he has of unrestricted warfare without consequence is mistaken. And we're happy to keep this going. And I could do this all day.
Well, the unrestricted warfare is the reference to the viciousness of the attacks on the Lincoln Project. Look, I mean, I think all of us who have been engaged in these wars over the last couple of years, you get used to the fact that we're hated, we're disliked, we're, yeah. you know, either
you're
we are
so unimportant, we have to destroy you.
Yeah, exactly. It sort of toggles back and forth between you're so irrelevant, we're going to make fun of you, to you are so evil and so dangerous that you are going to destroy America single-handedly. The ultimate troll is that they are obsessed with you. And is interesting watching. There was a week or it feels like you track this closer than I do, but it felt like about 2 weeks ago, it was like the bat signal went up from the White House and all of their media allies had to like do the Lincoln Project is just the worst people in the world.
Oh,
they are obsessed with you.
The degree to which, and then going back to Jared, and I'll give people a little peek behind the curtain. The food chain runs from Jared Kushner to Jason Miller, or as people generally know him, Baby Daddy, Jason Miller. And they have conference calls about us. They have Slack channels just about what we're doing in their campaign. They are obsessive about the role we're playing in this narrative. More than I think they focus on us on a daily basis to a degree that's so disproportionate to how much they're after Biden on a daily basis that it's almost disturbing. And yeah, they've gone after everybody's family and everybody's personal life and everybody, and they're digging and digging and digging, and they're going to keep doing it until they realize that, you know, that the shoe fits on both, the shoe can fit on the other foot rather easily. So.
Okay, so the more substantive complaint, particularly among the anti-Trumpers, is that when you went from going after Donald Trump to going after the Republican senators, and I'm part of this burn it down thing, you know, remember their names, that basically, you know, the Lincoln Project became Democrats. You are just functioning as a Democratic super PAC.
Well, they can believe that all they want, but it's not like we weren't explicit. In our opening gambit, we said that we wanted to remove Donald Trump from office and then to eliminate Trumpism and its enablers. And everybody that's on that list, everybody we've gone after, is an enabler of Trumpism. Charlie, I'm a big believer in politics that pain is the only teacher. Mm-hmm. You learn more from loss and suffering than you do from victory. And because pain is the only real teacher, it is important that these people who have either collaborated joyously with Trump and Trumpism, and therefore, by the way, abandoned all the things about conservatism that they claimed to once believe, limited government, the rule of law, the Constitution, the role of the executive, all those things that we once claimed were central to our conservatism, they've abandoned. But those people that have joyously collaborated with him, they're on the list. The people who were too chicken shit and cowardly to stand up, they're on the list. And if it takes a Democratic win in the Senate to make them wonder what the hell they did wrong and to make them conform their behavior to the actual tenets of conservatism again, then that's the pain I'm willing to suffer. I don't have to agree with Joe Biden on everything ideologically. I don't. But I recognize that the people today who are the cheerleaders of Trumpism and who believe that the greatest evil in American politics is the Lincoln Project, those people need to wake the hell up, because Donald Trump is the cause of their pain, not us. Donald Trump is the cause of the destruction of the Republican brand, not us. And I believe in a center-right party. I believe in limited government and individual liberty and the Constitution and the things I've always believed in. I have not become a, you know, woke progressive. I have, however, recognized, I think like you and many, many others have, that Donald Trump is so consequential and so deadly to the party as we knew it and wish it, that it has to all be burned down. You have to salt the earth where Trumpism once stood. And these people that are you know, bleeding all over the pages of, you know, Rich Lowry, and bleeding all over the pages of National Review about us, they are looking at us as this great evil, and they're not facing up to the fact that because of the economic incentives that they face, that their base will walk away from them. And they're not going to be their base will walk away from them if they're not pro-Trump. They're not a journal of ideas. These people are no longer about ideas. They are part of the enablers of the cult mechanism of Trumpism. And so,
I think it's very clear that if it was about ideas, things would be playing out very differently. So I've said this over and over again, that my time horizon, I'm not proud of this necessarily, my time horizon is just the election and the aftermath.
Yeah.
And very hard for me to focus on what's going to happen afterwards. So people say, well, you know, if in fact you do burn it all down, and Joe Biden becomes the president and you have the progressives who control both the House and the Senate, you're going to own all of those policies. And I'm actually saying, look, I'm prepared to make the pivot to say, this was the cancer. This was the fire. We put it out. Now let's move on. And I'm going to continue to oppose the things I've always continued. But but this is such an existential threat. We will deal with this now. We'll worry about the redecorating later. And I have no problem in saying that I'm going to push back against some of those policies. But I have to ask you about this quote from John Weaver when he talked to Greg Sargent at the Washington Post, which said that your group is, and I'm looking at it right here, is preparing to vehemently oppose efforts by Republican senators to obstruct and stymie Biden's agenda should he win the presidency.
Yeah, Charlie, I wouldn't overthink that quote.
Okay.
Because, you know, I wasn't sitting out on the interview, but let me say this. The games that the Trumpist world is going to play moving forward, and I think, and I do know specifically in part of that he was referring to the issues around, you know, that they're going to play fuck around on the most important thing Biden's going to have to do, and that's respond to COVID.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to do everything they can to try to pre-fail him on the COVID crisis. I think that is a very dangerous place to be, and I will fight back and oppose things on that front. But So look, there are going to be things that have to be done in this country that need a reset. And there are things Republicans need to look at about whether or not some of the things we've advocated in the past, 20 years have held true to our values.
Right.
I mean, the spending we've been in right now has been absurd. The degree to which that tax bill, which they all knew, and I wrote about it in my first book, they all understood the tax bill, 85% of the benefit accrued to about 150 to 175 hedge funds, Wall Street banks, and high net worth individuals. They understood that. They knew it very clearly. And that it planted a gigantic fiscal bomb under this country. So there are a lot of questions I think Republicans are going to need to answer, especially if they're in the minority in the Senate, of where are you going to go? And how are you going to sell the ideas of things like, wow, $600 a week is just too much. It makes you too lazy during the time of a plague and an economic collapse. I think that there's a limited runway for the kind of Tea Party vibe that was popular before Trump, and an even more limited runway with the American voters for the kind of obstructionist politics that will probably mark the era of Mitch McConnell as minority leader.
So tell me about this new initiative. I'm reading in Politico that that you've teamed up with a group called Vote Common Ground, which is sort of a progressive group to target white evangelicals and white Catholics, obviously two demographics that Trump won big back in 2016, but who appear to be losing some patience with the president's behavior. So you're making common cause now with this group targeting a specific demographic of Christians. Tell me about that. Who are these people?
Well, remember, Charlie, we're a political organization. We're not a policy shop. We don't have to agree with everybody on everything, as long as our goal is to defeat Donald Trump. And if Donald Trump loses a small fraction of his Catholic support in Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, game's over. If he loses a small fraction of his evangelical base in North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, the game is over. There are a lot of areas that where Donald Trump was able to present the mythological demon that was Hillary Clinton. And look, I've said it before. She was the creature of a 25-year Republican campaign to turn her into the worst demon in the universe. And that idea that she was this uniquely horrible individual was wired into Republicans' consciousness at a very fundamental level. So white evangelicals could shrug and say, you know, I don't like him. He's a scumbag, but at least he's not Hillary. And they were able to do that comfortably. We want to make that a little less of a comfortable choice going forward in 2020. And I think that that's already happening. We've seen drop off with evangelicals. We've seen drop off with Catholics because, you know, even conservative Catholics look at things like kids in cages and a lot of Donald Trump's other personal behaviors that are uncharitable and, to put it mildly, as anathema. So in those cases, I think there is a meaningful shot at breaking off a few points here and there. And this is a game of small numbers.
It doesn't take that many to flip these states. Okay, so your book, Running Against the Devil, really began with a cry from the heart to the Democrats, do not screw this thing up.
Correct.
And it was really aimed at them. And you wrote this at a time when it was certainly possible that the Democrats could have nominated a Bernie Sanders or somebody else who, and I still think that even with everything that's going on, had the Democrats nominated Bernie Sanders, this thing would be a nail biter right now.
Oh, look, if it was Bernie Sanders, I think Trump wins 42, 44 states.
Yeah.
Blows him
even
out.
Under these circumstances.
Even under these circumstances, because it's one thing to say, Joe Biden is a Marxist socialist who will bring on Antifa. It's another thing to say with Bernie Sanders, because a lot of American voters would go, oh, yeah, he actually is a Marxist. Oh, shit. And I know I'll piss off the bros for saying that, but, you know.
They're pissed off anyway.
They're pissed off anyway. The funniest thing to me is the hard Bernie bros and National Review are essentially identical when writing about the Lincoln Project.
Oh yeah,
the horseshoe has met with those groups. But so when I wrote the book, when I turned in the first draft for the hardcover, Joe Biden was in fifth place.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this was absolutely going to be President Pete. Okay, and so there was a sense in the minds of a lot of people that you know, and Bernie was in second at the time, and then rising fast. When the book came out of edit, Bernie was ahead. And so, you know, my framing of this was, here's how Republicans have done you guys in elections at every level, from dog catcher to president. Here are the mistakes that the Republicans have always anticipated you will make, because you make them again and again and again. Because my theory, which holds up really well, is that Democrats are holistically bad at politics. They do some things in some campaigns really, really well. Okay, sometimes they'll have a candidate who is fantastic on message. Pete Buttigieg, right? Sometimes they'll have a candidate who is the best policy nerd in the world, Elizabeth Warren. Sometimes they'll have a candidate who is charismatic and avuncular and appeals to, you know, the sort of center in America. That's a Bill Clinton or even a Barack Obama. Sometimes you have a candidate who appeals to the hot, hot progressive base, Bernie. Okay. None of these things tend to come together. You got to do all the things right. You've got to raise the money and do the work and do the organizing. And look, in the era of COVID, the organizing is a lot different than it would have been in another circumstance. But here we are.
But here's something I don't think you've probably seen. New Republic has a review of this this book about Never Trumpers by is it Salden and Tellis?
Uh-huh.
And they assigned it to a very lefty Yale professor who hates Never Trump. Just
right.
And here's the conclusion. While the authors are right that the Never Trump phenomenon will have lasting effects, those effects are not the ones they propose. Its significance, even if it was born on the right, is that it has succeeded overwhelmingly in a centrist containment of the left. Its historic role turns out to be not among Republicans so far, but within a Democratic Party whose members have chosen to convert enemies into friends. Amazing. Setting up a guardrail against the capture of their party by the left. The legacy of Never Trump so far is stopping progress rather than saving democracy. Now, my reaction to that is he says that like it's a bad thing. It's like, no, that's exactly right. Right. We were warning the Democrats.
I'm happy that he understands that there is a consequence to political courage and that's an affirmative consequence. But I am always fascinated by people. And I remember Ted Cruz said something one time to the effect when they were in the minority, I'd rather have 35 real committed blah, blah, blah than the majority. I'm like, you're a goddamn idiot.
Yeah.
And this idea that they could have progressive purity across the country. And one of the things I describe in my book in Running Against the Devil is that this idea that informs a lot of progressive journalism that comes out of New York City and Boston and California and Seattle and Oregon and blah, 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 is that the whole country is super woke. They're just waiting for the right person, and that the working class vanguard will come charging from the cornfields with pitchforks and torches at the right signal. The country's just not that woke outside of the coasts. A Democrat in Ohio, even the most progressive Democrat in Ohio, is much less progressive than a moderate Democrat in Los Angeles or Boston or New York City. And so this idea that there's a homogenous political culture across the country is just wrong. And it's important to, you know, look at what works in the states where you're running on an electoral college system, which it is what it is. They're not going to get away from that. And realize that, you know, Michigan is not as woke as they would like it to be.
No,
and neither is Wisconsin.
We have Madison, but I keep thinking, you know, really, do you folks understand how this is actually playing in the state that's going to determine the Electoral College? Okay, so Rick, give me a preview. Your book's coming out in about 10 days.
Yep.
The updater. So what do you say? I mean, basically, since you were screaming in the face of Democrats not to screw this up, if you want to beat Donald Trump, what do you say? What is the updated warning?
This is still not a policy election. It is a referendum on Donald Trump. Keep the focus on Donald Trump. This is a referendum on his handling of COVID almost exclusively at this point. This is a referendum not on some sweeping vision of what you want to do policy-wise or in the economy, because Americans right now are terrified of not being able to pay their rent. They're terrified of not being able to get food for their kids. This is a point where the kind of leadership and the kind of political messaging that's going to work keeps the focus on the failures of Donald Trump and just says, we will make this different. We will do a different, we will do a better job. Joe Biden is a decent man. Donald Trump is an indecent man. Joe Biden gives a damn about you. Donald Trump doesn't give a damn about you. Joe Biden would never accept 150,000 dead. Donald Trump laughs it off. So it's knowing what the race really is and not what you want it to be.
No, I agree with that. Absolutely. So since we're talking to Florida man here, what do you make of the president having spent every single day since forever warning about the dangers and the evils of mail-in voting, how it's going to destroy the election, how we can't do it, how it's going to be fraud, maybe we should delay the election, suddenly tweets out today that, hey, I didn't mean you people in Florida.
Right.
Because that's just crazy.
This is the reality bubble, the magical reality bubble around Donald Trump and Republicans in Florida who have been begging him. So one thing people should know as Florida man, one of the reasons that Republicans took over the state from the Democrats was that back in 1994, the party chairman, a guy named Tom Slade, set up this program called Operation Sledgehammer. And it was a 25-year long march to destroy the Democratic Party in Florida. A fundamental underpinning of that program was absentee ballots and early voting and mail voting. And Republicans got really, really, really good at it. And there's been a freakout among the professional Republican class in Florida for weeks. And they've been begging the campaign in the White House, please God, shut the hell up. Because this idea that mail voting is bad and wrong has percolated into the Republican mind. And so they're gambling everything on Election Day voting, which is the same mistake that Democrats used to make. Mm-hmm. The Republicans used to rack up an early vote total that even if you lost on Election Day, you'd come out okay. Well, that's not happening anymore because Donald Trump is a moron and he has basically given his people a suicide pill.
Well, the same, by the way, the same story took place here in Wisconsin, where under Reince Priebus, they turned around. It used to be the Democrats had a big edge on getting out the vote. But when Reince Priebus was the chairman of the Republican Party here, he really turned the Republican Party into a vote turnout. I mean, monolith. And I mean, that's how you got Scott Walker. Mm-hmm. That's how you got the state flipped around. And that's been, of course, been shifting. Now we saw that in the state Supreme Court election. But. Yeah, I imagine that Republicans all around the country are going, you know, Mr. President, people are actually listening to you, and these are our voters. And if you suppress the mail-in vote, those are your voters. I don't know whether you saw this, the latest story out of Wisconsin, where you have a Trump-supporting lawyer who was the one who turned in petitions to get Kanye West on the ballot here in Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah. And so the guy that's running it is a former Matt Schlapp employee.
Which is interesting because you try to think, in Wisconsin, who do you think you're going to get to vote for Kanye West? Are you going to drain off? Do they honestly think that African-American voters in Milwaukee and Racine are going to go, huh, well, I was going to vote against Donald Trump. I was going to vote for Joe Biden. But if Kanye West is running for president, I'm going to vote for Kanye West. The contempt for the voters is so profound, and that's generally not something you find in winning campaigns. Because trust me, African American voters in Wisconsin, you know, still remember 2016 intently. They are paying a great deal of attention, and the kind of person that would go into the voting booth and say, "Hey, screw it all, let's burn it down by voting for Kanye West," that was probably a Trump voter to begin with.
Exactly. And look, this is one of those things where, and I've been in a number of campaigns where the Republicans would go out and recruit a Green Party candidate. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that you'd pay some kid 20 grand to sit on his couch and play Xbox, right?
Sure.
But it would pull a percent or two or five, whatever. And it would be an ugly kind of drain on the Democrats. They couldn't get over it. Look, there's a lot of people that believe that Karl Rove paid Ralph Nader in 2004 to be in that race, to drain off just enough of John Kerry's top line to make it impossible to get the Electoral College. And so in all these things, there is a degree to which the shenanigans that are going on should be anticipated and expected. But the fact that Kanye is being held up by people who were the person who did it in Wisconsin apparently had been litigating a case for Trump a week before.
Yeah, very subtle.
This is very subtle. These people aren't exactly they're not sending their best. Let's put it that way.
Well, they never do. Okay, so are you concerned? How worried are you that there's going to be complacency because of these early polls? That people
absolutely are absolutely terrified of it, Charlie.
You are terrified.
Terrified of it. I have a message to Democrats. First off, never read a national survey. Don't ever read a national poll. If you want to base your decisions based on national polling, don't. I beg of you, please, God, don't. The essential question here is to maintain the voter intensity against Trump all the way to November. And this 90-day sprint we've got is going to require everybody to stay focused and stay on target and not buy into the sense of, okay, he's in the dustbin of history. Donald Trump is a wily creature. He's a feral animal. And we need to make sure that we don't ever take our eye off the fact that he's got a lot of tricks. He still has a ton of money in his campaign. He still has the ability to go out there and blow things up, the ability to do things by abusing the office of the president that could cause all kinds of consequences. This election is a long damn way from over.
Vice presidential choice for Joe Biden. Thoughts?
I have a favorite in the pile, and it's Tammy Duckworth. Just my personal mm-hmm. opinion, not speaking for the Lincoln Project, just speaking for me. Mm-hmm. I think she is a great American story. I think she's got a ton of personality and charisma. I think that her service to the country is both honorable and notable at the same time. I think that Mike Pence would be nervous as a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs around her. But look, Joe Biden's going to make a choice. It's just got to be somebody who's ready to be president on day one, who scans that way. And so, you know, look, if it's Harris or Duckworth, you know, I think those two choices both have their, and they seem to be, mm-hmm. Harris, Duckworth, and Rice seem to be the three that are still in the mix.
Okay, tell me about Susan Rice, because I mean, that's catnip for Republicans.
I mean, right. I think she brings a lot of poise into the game, but Republicans will turn this into the Benghazi show.
Yep.
And they're going to try to do that anyway, but, you know, we'll see. I also think there's one thing that Biden people need to keep in mind is there's no hurry on this. They're racing along. Why bother? Wait, drag it out. Make it a surprise.
You know, I'm glad to hear you say that, because I'm seeing all these stories about, you know, the delay in this is getting people concerned. What's the holdup? I agree with you. What's the rush, especially, you know, if every single day Donald Trump is digging himself a deeper hole, just hold off. Maybe he'll give more airtime to himself. Maybe he'll give another interview tomorrow. Why would you step on that story?
Right. Why would you make this election about anything other than Donald Trump, who is screwing the pooch every day?
Well, I hope they take your advice. Rick Wilson, we should mention that you are in the podcast business. You and Molly Jong Fast have a great podcast over at The Daily Beast. It's once a week, right? And you've had some fantastic.
It's twice a week.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
No, don't worry.
Who do you have this week?
Well, we had Padma Lakshmi and mm-hmm. Joy Reid on for the Tuesday pod. And we have John Kerry. And a special guest for Friday's pod.
Excellent. Well, I never miss it. I'm looking forward to it. And hey, thanks for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast.
Anytime.
Appreciate it very much, Rick. And we're looking forward to your book. And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.